Welcome back to the Center of Law and Economics video log series. Today we're very happy to have Melissa Wasserman from the University of Texas at Austin Law School. Hi Melissa, it's good to have you.
Thank you, I'm excited to be here.
Melissa is a law professor with a JD as well as a PhD in chemical engineering, and she uses this unique expertise to study innovation policy. Today, we're going to be talking about her paper, A Prescription to Rising Drug Prices, Patent Office Reform. This is joint work with your frequent collaborator, Michael Frakes from Duke University. Now, your paper tackles a very real problem. People can't afford drugs, and your research one particular source of high prices, namely low-quality secondary patents. And then you have one particular fix to that problem, which is giving patent officers more time to review patent applications. So first, could you tell us what bad secondary patents are and why they are causing part of the problem here?
Yeah, of course. So secondary pharmaceutical patents are patents that are not on the active ingredient that forms the basis of the drug, but instead secondary pharmaceutical patents are on peripheral features of the drug product. So a common one would be a formulation patent, which involves the active ingredient and the inactive ingredient and may have directed towards the mode of administration, such as a capsule or a gel or a controlled release formulation. Another example would be something called a polymorph. So if the active ingredient exists in a solid crystalline state, it could exist in different crystalline states. And these polymorphs are important because they affect the biological activity of the drug as well as its ease of manufacture. Now, there's been a lot of controversy associated with these secondary pharmaceutical patents because pharmaceutical firms will get a whole series of patents associated with one drug. And because drugs patents expire, or all patents expire in the US 20 years from filing, it's a way that pharmaceutical firms, people have argued, can elongate their exclusivity period associated with a single drug. And so many people argue that these secondary pharmaceutical patents are less innovative and many of them are invalid, meaning they don't meet the patentability standards and should never have been issued in the first place. And so if you have the US Patent and Trademark Office issuing these invalid secondary patents, right, they can essentially drive up drug prices because they delay generic entry. Yes, they may ultimately be invalidated by a court, but there's some delay in when they are, right? You have to bring them back and litigate them for a certain period of time. So we focus on this particular fix of giving more time to the Patent and Trademark Office, and we think this is really an underexplored area, right? A lot of the proposals associated with drug pricing really call for sort of large changes in how pharmaceutical drugs are priced in the U.S. We think this is really an overlooked way and like really low-hanging fruit. You know, just give some examiners some more time, they'll issue fewer invalid patents, and this could have a dramatic effect on drug prices.
Well, yeah, that's certainly promising. And so you show empirically that, you know, the less time patent examiners have, the more often they grant applications that shouldn't be granted. Now, how can you measure this empirically? Which ones are the bad patents that we don't want? And also, how do you know it's really the time constraint that's causing bad patents to be issued?
Yeah. So one of course, the hard things is how do we actually know the U.S. patent, the pharma patent that's been issued, is invalid? And that's really difficult to know, right? We can't just track only the ones that have been litigated to finality because it's such a tiny, small fraction. So what we do is we look at applications that are filed, the same application that's filed both in the U.S. and in Europe, and actually also typically in Japan as well. And so these are sort of patent families. And the good thing for us is that patents that are listed in the Orange Book, right, that are patents that are actually referred to drugs that have been marketed in the U.S. and approved by the FDA are almost always filed in Europe and Japan as well. Yeah. And then what we look at is whether the patent that's issued in the U.S. is also issued in Europe. And we use this issuing in Europe as a proxy for validity. And what we find, right, is actually relatively high issuance weights of our active ingredients in Europe and a relatively large amount. I think about 76% of our secondary patents that are issued in the US are also issued in Europe as well. So that's what we use for our validity marker. And then how do we go about testing for time, right, in the US to see is really time having an effect on the quality of issued patents? So what we do is we get a variation in time in two different ways. The first way is we exploit the fact that as examiners in the US get promoted up the pay grade, the pay scale, in the US, each promotion is associated with about a 10 to 15% reduction in their time they're given to review applications. So what we do is we kind of follow examiners as they get promoted, and then we look to see if the US patents that they're getting issued, that they issued, what happens to that in Europe. And so when you have more time as an examiner, when you're at a lower GS level, right, the patents that you get issued, that you're allowing in the US, get issued in Europe at a some rate, but as you get promoted and get less and less time, the patents you're issuing become less and less likely to also be allowed in Europe.
And so that kind of establishes more time, better quality patents. And so, but presumably giving people more time also means more bureaucracy, more cost. So do we know that the benefits outweigh the cost, if your reform would be implemented?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, like now, let's say we've convinced you that time is a problem, right? The solution is not necessarily just to give more time. And there's actually been people who've argued against this in the literature who have argued essentially that because so few patents become economically significant, right, it makes more sense just to make those detailed validity determinations in the courts rather than to increase the time for all applications to be reviewed at the US Patent and Trademark Office. So Michael and I have argued elsewhere that we disagree with that. So there was an influential paper written by Mark Limley who had made this particular argument that the patent office was rashly ignorant, right? It made sense for them not to spend much time reviewing applications. But Limley was really limited in the data that he had at the time, really, and had to guess at some of the key relationships between if you increase time, how many fewer invalid patents, for example, would be issued, and how much litigation savings would that allow. So Michael and I, in another paper, right, revisited this issue where we used more robust data and sophisticated empirical techniques to really estimate those key relationships. And we had come out for all patent applications that it would make more sense, right? That the benefits would outweigh the cost if we increase time to review all applications. Now, this case in pharmaceuticals, we think, is an even easier case to make, right? Most of these patents, these orange book list of patents, so they have to do with patents that drugs that have been approved in the US, these are really highly valuable patents. Right? And so, if we could look into the US Patent and Trademark Office and determine which patents, if issued, were going to be highly valuable, those would make a ton of sense to increase the resources to review because those are the ones that are going to be particularly costly to society if we make a mistake. And so, we think that the case here is easier. And so, what we do, right, is we try to do a cost-benefit analysis. We think the primary costs associated with increasing time to examiners are going to be personnel expenses to the PTO. They're going to have to hire more examiners because we think they're going to want to keep the same throughput of
Of
applications.
course.
And then the benefits we think are multiple, right? We're going to get some litigation savings benefits because now fewer invalid patents are being issued. They're not going to be as many patents to be litigated. But really, what made us excited about looking at pharmaceutical patents is that we may also kind of get estimates for consumer surplus and deadweight loss. So this is the idea, right, that it, once generics come onto the market, right, the drug is so much cheaper, and so consumers are going to save a lot, right, by being able to pay the generic prices rather than the patented prices. And then deadweight loss is right off us this idea of people that were priced out, right, that now can afford it at the generic cost. And so we're able, right, to get an estimate about how much earlier generic entry we would have, and we estimate it to be about 19 years of earlier generic entry if we increase examiner time allocations by 50%. And then we're able to rely upon a rather robust economic literature that really documents how quickly generics come in and what kind of volume sales generics have versus brand to get these estimates of these consumer surplus and deadweight loss. And we come out overwhelmingly to say the benefits would kind of swamp the costs associated with giving examiners more time to review pharmaceutical patents.
One thing that doesn't seem to be accounted for necessarily in the cost-benefit analysis is maybe the effect on innovation. So given that this is the law and economics of innovation, video log series, maybe a question about that. So on the one hand, we would think that issuing fewer patents would be issued after the reform, which might hurt profits for drug companies and reduce their benefit to innovate. On the other hand, you're saying these aren't actually the patents we want, so maybe we wouldn't lose beneficial innovation. So can you say something about how the reform might potentially influence, incentives to innovate here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So obviously, if you're going to cut the revenue of pharmaceutical firms, right, they're going to say this is hurting our incentives to innovate. So if you're starting with this idea, right, in the U.S. that our prescription drug prices are too high, right, any sort of proposal to bring down the costs associated with prescription drugs are going to have this effect of lowering the revenue on big pharma, right? And big pharma then is going to turn around and say, right, we don't have as many incentives to innovate. So what we try to argue, at least in our paper, is that at least in comparison with other ways to cut costs, right, or control prices, ours will have the least sort of negative impact on innovation. And this is because, as you said, these are patents that should have never been issued in the first place. And the patentability standards are set to generally track incentives to innovate. We don't give patents on things unless they're new, right? Because if we already have it, we don't need to have a patent to induce somebody to invent that. The same thing is we don't give patents on things that are just trivial advancements over our current understanding of science, because again, we were going to get that advancement anyways. We don't need a patent to induce somebody to try to come up with that invention. So compared with price controls, which can be kind of a blunt way to decrease prices, right, and doesn't take into account any innovation, I think, incentives typically, or not very fine-tuned ones, we think our proposal is better, right, because it's supposedly going to target those secondary patents that aren't innovative to begin with, that we think the pharmaceutical company really didn't need that patent to induce that innovation. Now, that being said, right, if somebody sort of argues, well, maybe pharma needs these invalid secondary patents, right, to get enough money to innovate, if that's the case, what we think is the patentability standards should be changed, right? If the patentability standards aren't set for optimal innovation and pharmaceuticals, let's change those. This can't possibly be the second best alternative, right? The fact that your patent is going to get allowed or not is going to depend upon the happenstance of the GS level it gets randomly assigned. Right. That to us doesn't seem like good innovation policy. Let's go ahead and think about changing the patentability standards to more better account for innovation in the pharmaceutical area.
You can convince the USPTO to lobby for this. I do hope you get this implemented.
Thank you
for coming on today, Melissa.
Yes, my pleasure.
And this is it for today from the Center of Law and Economics VLOG series. Bye for now.